Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It's the 27th of June. Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us. You may have seen the headline in Friday's paper, Culture Clash, Westerners See Muslims as Intolerant and Violent. Muslims sue Westerners as greedy and selfish. Survey of people in 15 nations. That's quite a survey. Shows deteriorating relations. We'll talk about some of the results of that poll from the Pew Global Attitudes Project with Dr. Alvin Schmidt of Illinois College here during this half hour. In the second half hour of this second hour, Dr. Daniel Hoffman will be our guest. We'll roll history back a bit and talk about the Crusades. Were the Crusades simply a greedy and fanatical Christian empire coming down on a peaceful Muslim people and peaceful Muslim nations? We'll answer that question in about 25 minutes here on Issues Etc. The third hour of Issues Etc. We'll be talking with Dr. John Seleska about a dying man's consolation. No, Dr. Seleska is not dying, but he has assembled some Bible passages for all of us, the consolation in the face of death. That's coming up in the third hour of the program. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is a regular guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, the Pew Global Attitudes Project stole the title from your book, The Great Divide, How Westerners and Muslims View Each Other. Is that a pretty apt description of the mutual attitudes of Western and Muslim peoples in the United States, a great divide?
Yes, I think so. That's one reason I chose with the publisher the title when we published my book a couple of years ago. And so I don't know if they borrowed it from my title or not. I don't really know. I'll take the compliment if that is one.
From your looking at the Pew Center's poll about these attitudes vis-a-vis Westerners and Muslims, what does anything surprise you? And if anything, what is it?
No, really, I'm not surprised about any of it. Maybe a little bit that most Muslims apparently are in a state of denial and don't want to believe that 9/11 happened as a result of Arabs doing it. And perhaps that's the big surprise there, that I wasn't aware that that many would deny this kind of phenomenon. Also, if one recalls, right shortly after 9/11, there were many Muslims in Middle Eastern countries that were out on the streets celebrating what happened. Now, why did they celebrate? They must have, at that time at least, believed that it was their Arab friends that did it. At least one could make that conclusion. So now for them to say that they don't believe that the Arabs were engaged in what happened in 9/11, I think is not only interesting, but rather an unexplainable comment, or, as I said, they're in a state of denial.
We're talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's authored this book called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, about the new Pew Research Center poll on Westerners' attitudes towards Muslims and Muslims' attitudes toward Westerners. If you were looking at this story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, it describes it as a clash of cultures. Now, it certainly is a clash of cultures, but is it more than just a cultural clash? I mean, that seems the most convenient way of reading these survey results. But, Dr. Schmidt, is this more than just a cultural clash? Is it, in fact, also a religious clash?
Yes, of course it is. You know, when you get to the Muslim world, it is difficult to separate the religion from the culture. And so when you're speaking of one, you're really speaking of the other. And so we do have, yes, a cultural clash, because in the West, even though Christianity has greatly influenced the West in the past, Christianity now in the West, particularly in Western Europe, is basically, you might say, dead. People don't really honor too much of what the Christian heritage gave them. So in Europe, it's definitely a culture, largely, increasingly, divorced from Christianity, whereas in the Islamic world, culture and religion are essentially synonymous. So it's some of both. But as far as Westerners are concerned, it's probably more of a cultural clash. And as far as the Islamic world is concerned, it's probably a religious clash.
One of the things that struck me as odd is that when the question is asked about the general relation between Muslims and Westerners, from country to country, most of the countries seem to say that they are generally bad. I think the highest percentage that said it was bad were the Nigerian Muslims at 77%. Only 10% of Nigerian Muslims felt that there was any good relationship or generally good relationship between Muslims and Westerners. Kind of odd, tipping the scales in the other direction, are Spanish Muslims, who 49% of believed there were generally good relations between Muslims and Westerners, and only 23% said that those relations were generally bad. What is unique, if anything, about Spain in that it's kind of the odd man out among all of the nations where Muslims live as to this relationship here?
Well, if you take the Spanish statistic that you just cited, it would indicate that the West, in this case, at least Spanish people, have forgotten, I suppose, what once happened to their country when Muslims occupied it for 800 years, from the early 700s to 1492. It seems that, they have less anger relative to having been occupied for 800 years. Something like this hasn't happened in the reverse, where the West has occupied an Islamic country for 800 years or 400 years, even for that matter. So to me, that's not terribly surprising, perhaps because the West has in many ways tried to be more understanding and have toleration toward Islam in spite of what it has experienced and even now is experiencing. Even now, for example, we see that in Western Europe, according to this Pew research, the Westerners have a more favorable attitude of Islam than the other way around, which again indicates, I think, that, well, what shall I call it? The Muslim religion, the Islamic religion, is so strong here that it overpowers any kind of cooperation and toleration between these two worlds, in spite of the fact that they increasingly come to the West, like in France and in England and so on. In fact, the research, as I recall, said that the people in England, for example, had a more favorable attitude and that the attitudes against the Western were more pronounced in England than they were in the other European countries. And that is, to me, somewhat surprising.
Dr. Schmidt, there's another question asked in this poll. Is there a conflict between being a devout Muslim and living in a modern society? Now, the U.S., Germany, Spain, Russia, Great Britain, generally in pretty large majorities, well, the U.S. is pretty evenly split, but in those other European countries, in large majorities said, yes, there is a conflict between being a devout Muslim and living in a modern society.
Yes, of course. If they take, as I have said many times in different contexts, including in my book, that if you are a devout, informed Muslim, you will definitely find major conflicts relative to what they believe and relative to what you find practiced in the West. And that, I think, is perhaps underlying a lot of these still strong anti-Western views, because they see what the West does, and much of what we do in the West is, of course, often not compatible with Christianity or Islam, for example, licentious behavior on the sexual level and other kinds of behavior can be seen, for example, as a conflict and as a threat to them. And that is exactly what they do see it as. Now, the people who are not informed and devout Muslims, we don't know a great deal about them. Really very, very little. I've seen no study that has ever really examined them. And so what their opinion is, we don't know. I suppose they are in many cases nominal or what we shall say pseudo-Muslims, in reality only in name but not in reality. And they may see no conflict. And perhaps that's very true of Muslims in the United States more so than I would think it is in the European countries like France or even in England.
So this might explain why German Muslims, French Muslims, Spanish Muslims, Muslims in Jordan, Turkey, and Egypt, Nigeria, all believe in majorities that Muslims can be devout and live in a modern democratic society, whereas those who are not Muslims in those countries do see the conflict there between devout Islam and
yes,
modern
society.
Yes, I think
society. So. Mm-hmm.
So we've really seen here again not only a divide between West and the Islamic world, but also a divide within Islam, Western Muslims versus, I guess, Islamic Muslims or Muslims living in Islamic states.
Yeah, now, if there is a divide in the Muslim world, however, it's a very unknown divide because the people who are Muslims in name only, nominal, whatever one wants to call them, really do not make themselves known, even in this country. They say, I don't accept the teachings, for the most part, what I find in the Quran pertaining, for example, to violence. They don't say that. Why don't they say that? Well, I don't know for sure. I can make a couple of, I think, informed guesses. One is if they did, they would get in conflict with other devout, serious Muslims, even in the United States of America. And there's been evidence of that. So I think for one reason, even those who are secular Muslims, if you will, are afraid to come out and admit that there is a divide in their own community. In other words, the divide, if it's there, and it may very well be, is one that's unknown, unrecognized, and invisible for the most part.
One thing that struck me here, too, in the results under the question of whether or not democracy can do well among Muslims, Turkey, where arguably a form of democracy has prevailed for the better part of a generation or longer, is the, of all the countries surveyed, Jordan, Indonesia, Egypt, Pakistan, is the least optimistic about whether or not democracy can work well in their own country.
That's true, and because, again, if you take Islamic doctrine seriously, it is hard to see how it can function democratically, a country. And this is why when, for example, it was instituted in Turkey in the 1920s, now almost, well, at least 80 years plus, you have a form of democracy, more so than in any other Islamic country. But even there, it's not the kind of democracy that the West has experienced and has been promoting and what we tend to value. It's a democracy where there is a tremendous amount of lack of freedom and the like, particularly on the religious level, pertaining to those who are not Muslims. Christians have a very difficult time even repairing churches in liberal, if you will, secular Islam, a country of Turkey. And also when the government became secular, quote-unquote democratic in Turkey, one of the things that Ataturk did was to basically outlaw certain kinds of Islamic behavior and at least greatly curb it. So again, that indicates that even in that country, they recognize that true full-blown Islam does not work or is not compatible with a with democratic values. And so he muted a lot of them, outlawed some of the behavior, some of those which are coming back. But again, it shows the conflict between democracy and Islam is very, very pronounced. And, of course, that's basically what we're talking about when we see a conflict between the West and the Islamic world.
We're talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of the book The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, about the new Pew Research Center poll on Westerners' attitudes toward Muslims and Muslims' attitudes toward Westerners. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Let's turn then to some of the other findings of this poll that may be surprising. One is what the paper calls a rare agreement between Muslims and Westerners that Muslim nations need to become more prosperous. What is the underlying cause, in your opinion, of the lack of or the failure of many Islamic nations to enter into first world kind of economic systems, first world prosperity?
Well, yes, that's a very good question, and one that is often not raised, and I'm kind of glad that the Pew Research did raise that issue. The Islamic world has never been known to be on the forefront of technology, science, and economic development. It has many, the advances it has made have largely been, if I may say, copied from the West. And why has it not been on the forefront of science and technology? For example, in my book, I cite that the Muslim world has more than, well, at least one-fifth of the world's population, but only 5% of scientific output comes from Muslim countries. The rest is from the West. And that has a lot to do with the fact of the nature of Islamic religion, which is not encouraged. In fact, there are examples that I cite in the book where, for example, new economic development and new thoughts were squelched and reversed back even in Turkey before the advent of it becoming more or less secular. So that accounts for its lack of prosperity, its lack of innovativeness and the like, in spite of the fact that one often reads in history books that Islam was very, very well advanced in the, oh, from the 800s to about 1100. For the most part, that's a myth that is repeated from one historian to another. Because if you look and see what actually they did accomplish in terms of development and economic progress, it's very, very minimal. And so it's an old story that their lack of prosperity is largely tied to their religion, and it basically hamshackles them, you know, in terms of what they may do, and new thoughts, new ideas, which are often underlying economic inventions or prosperity, are not encouraged. And so, to me, that's not surprising at all. In fact, it's been the history of the Islamic countries since their existence, for the most part.
Why are European and American Muslims generally more optimistic about Islam's potential economically, culturally, and as a religion?
Well, I don't know. I would venture to guess, and I could be wrong, that basically when you live in a free society, as you do in most of the Western countries, you have the optimism that accompanies freedom. Freedom permits you to move to one place in the West geographically. It permits you, for example, to change, you know, you can even change your religion, drop Christianity, if you will, become an unbeliever, and you will not in the Western world suffer any consequences. I mean, Christians have never loved seeing any of theirs fall away, but never have they been threatened with death when they do, as you do in the Islamic world. You fall away from the Islamic religion and you take your life in your own hands. So it obviously stifles freedom. And in the context of freedom, as I said, people tend to be optimistic, because if your freedom to move, your freedom to think, you tend to be, what shall I say, optimistic about not just yourself, but perhaps even about other groups such as Muslims.
Let's go to the phones and talk with Jerry, who calls from South County. Jerry, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for Dr. Schmidt. I appreciate it. I have your book, Dr. Schmidt. It's a wonderful book, The Great Divide. I see this in Iraq going on as a Sunni-Shiite power play, and we're not having any commitment from Iraq, from any of their Iraqi leaders, that that they will guarantee any type of freedom in Iraq. To them, democracy probably means an Ayatollah rules or something, because it's a generic word. I think our troops are in danger. They're sort of like fodder in between this power play, and I think we have to move back, maybe stay close by, but I think that these people have to, they've been fighting for centuries. I don't think they ever will resolve their power play, but I don't think our troops should be in the middle of it or even near it.
Jerry, thank you very much. Your thoughts on Jerry's comment?
She said it very well. I mean, I can't add much more to it. It's a tough situation, whether things will turn out to the benefit of Iraq becoming a democratic country remains to be seen. I'm hopefully optimistic about it. I pray about it, because our own welfare is in many cases involved as well. But it's not going to be an easy road, as she indicates. And Well, what more can one say? We need to pray about it, work about it, and ultimately, I don't think we ever had any real choice about going to Iraq and having done what we did as Americans. The alternative, not to do anything, I think was more harmful and dangerous than our having gone there. So she said it very well. There's a century-old conflict between the Shiites and the Sunnis, and will they ever cooperate remains to be seen. I hope and pray they will.
Dr. Schmidt, one of the headlines here reads, Westerners see Muslims as intolerant and violent, but if you look at the numbers, non-Muslims in the U.S., in the United States, do not in majorities share those opinions that Muslims are intolerant and violent. Are non-Muslims in the United States simply naive about worldwide Islam?
I think that's right. I probably couldn't say it any better. I really do think naive and perhaps uninformed.
What do they need to know about Islam to be better informed?
They need to read the Quran, even when the politicians in our country, our politicians in the United States, as well as in England. And there is a quote in the Pew study, again, from Madeleine Albright about Islam being falsely perceived or seen in this country as a terrorist religion. I keep saying, why do these people, including Albright, read the Quran? I venture to guess they have not. As I've mentioned before, there are over 100 violent present tense passages of violence in the Quran that many of the Muslims take seriously. And that's why we had 9/11, for example. And that's why we have a lot of what's going on in Iraq with the so-called insurgents. And I can't say anything more than that. They need to inform themselves, but people apparently don't. And so often what they get is what I call a politically correct spin on the media, which those people also have not read the Quran when they keep talking about Islam not being a terrorist religion, but a religion of peace. Well, 1,400 years of history, in addition to the Quran, show that that's not true.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. For more information on this book, call Regina Orthodox Press at 1-800-636-2470, 1-800-636-2470, and ask about The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West by Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we're going into this break, and when we come back, we'll stay with the issue of the West versus Islam, but roll back history a little bit, and that is to the Christian Crusades. Without a doubt, one of the darker eras in Christian history, but is it as dark as many believe it is? Were the Christian Crusades an offensive and unjust war effort on the part of a Christian empire determined to do away with or to deal with an encroaching Islam? Why were the Crusades carried out in the first place? What are we talking about when we're talking about the Crusades? Many Christians and others believe that the Crusades are just a series of short wars. What are we really talking about historically, and why did Christians go on the Crusades? We'll answer that question after this on Issues Etc.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We give thanks for the folks at LCMS World Relief because they are the hands and the feet that allow many people to reach out in charity and love to those who are less fortunate than we.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Arthur Just on the importance of LCMS World Relief.
In the Gospels, Jesus says that he came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And spending out his life for us on the cross is how he served us. Because Christ is in us, and we embody him in his mercy and love, we are to manifest that in our lives. And LCMS World Relief does exactly that, by reaching out with concrete expressions of Christ's love, mercy, and compassion to those who have been broken by storm and tempest, who, for whatever reason, need the kind of love and compassion that is in us because Christ is in us.
For more information or to donate to LCMS World Relief, call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. It's a representation of Christ. After an absence of several years, Superman returns to the theaters tomorrow to save Earth from certain disaster. This time around, the Man of Steel is being cast in a decidedly spiritual light. Steve Jordahl finds some think this potential Hollywood blockbuster has religious significance.
You might think it's just the latest comic book on celluloid, but many Christians who see Superman Returns will leave thinking there was something familiar about the film.
They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all, their capacity for good. I have sent them you, my only son.
Now that just sounds like something right out of the Gospel of John. It sounds like God the Father saying that he's going to send his son Jesus to the world to save the world.
Dr. Reg Grant of Dallas Seminary says the movie could be a good witnessing tool, courtesy of Hollywood.
The director, Bryan Singer, just offers up on a silver platter a golden opportunity for us to use this as a gospel starter with our friends.
Grant warns that the Superman of the movie is not always faithful to the Christ analogy. He doesn't come to redeem, but to help mankind achieve its potential. But Bob Smithhauser of Plugged In Magazine says it's another offering from Tinseltown that has a spiritual hue to it.
I think Hollywood is trying to tap into the things that resonate with people, and it's going to be, either for better or worse, spiritual themes a lot of times.
The world doesn't need a savior, and neither do I.
Actually, we do, but the one on the screen this week is definitely fictional. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
A Focus on the Family review will be available on PluggedInOnline.com tomorrow. Hollywood's recent crush on spirituality does not always mean good movies. The Da Vinci Code is a good example. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next midday, Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We talk with Dr. Paul Reiser, primary author for Family Health, Nutrition, and Fitness. It's an official book of the Focus on the Family Physicians Resource Council. And Charles Ford will tell us about Dietrich Bonhoeffer on the next Living Jubilee at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Reasonable Ethics, a Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns is the title of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Reasonable Ethics on our website, issuesetc.org. Reasonable Ethics by Dr. Robert Benny, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June.
Terrorism attacking Muslims in the Middle East. The Muslims did not attack the Christians. The Christians decided that Muslims were evil, and they were in Christian holy places, and so we ought to go over there and kill them, and so we did.
That's Pastor John Shelby Spong, Bishop John Shelby Spong, opining in an interview some time back about what the Christian Crusades were all about. We're going to be talking about the Christian Crusades. Well, John Shelby Spong says the Christian Crusades were Christian terrorism. Is that true? Was it an aggressive war? Was it a just war effort? Or do we need to be a little more nuanced when we talk about this period of Christian history, a rather long period, in fact, called the Christian Crusades? Dr. Daniel Hoffman joins us for this half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in numbers, you can join us as well with a question or a comment about the Christian Crusades, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Daniel Hoffman is Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland and author of the cover story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Hollywood versus History, Kingdom of Heaven and the Real Crusades. Dr. Hoffman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Well, deal first with the claim that we heard just there a moment ago from John Shelby Spong. When he talks about the Crusades, he says that they were Christian terrorism. Is it true?
Well, that's a pretty amazing claim. I guess we need to hear how he defines terrorism, but the Crusades were defensive in nature primarily. The Christians in the East, that is the Byzantine or Greek Christians, had been under pressure from Islam for 600 or 700 years prior to the Crusades, losing more and more territory to Muslim attacks. So it's pretty clear that there was a defensive element and a real need to defend Christian territory. So I wouldn't equate defense with terrorism.
Set the historical context. I think a lot of people, when they hear, even Christians, when they hear about the Christian Crusades, given kind of the broad ignorance of Christian history in general, think of one or two campaigns carried out over within maybe less than a century. But that seems pretty far from the actual timeline of this period of the Crusades.
Yes, that's true. It was a much longer time period than that. The First Crusade is usually thought to have begun in 1095 when the Pope at the time, Urban II, at a council in France, the Council of Clermont, called for a attempt to liberate the Holy Land and free up travel for Christian pilgrims to Jerusalem and other holy sites, as well as to aid Byzantine or Greek Christians. And so 1095 would be the beginning point of the process, but it continued on for 400, almost 500 years. Amazingly enough, at the time of Henry VIII, Christians were still talking about getting together and dropping some of the differences between the French and the English and banding together in a crusade against Islam. And the reason for that, that is the reason that it was such a long time period, is that Islam or various Muslim nations were the real world powers in the Middle Ages. And as late as, say, 1529, Suleiman the Magnificent, a Muslim leader, had besieged the city of Vienna in what most people would call Europe today. And so in the 16th century, Islam was still attacking and pressuring Christian territory. So that's why even at the time of Henry VIII, as I said, they were still thinking about having a crusade. So for about 500 years, really, there was talk of crusades in Europe. And most historians would date the actual crusades, the first through the fourth, from 1095 until 1204. But as I say, it continued on after that, and there were even later crusades, like the Crusades of St. Louis and so forth. But in the article, I only deal with really the first four crusades. There's enough to cover there rather than trying to do 400 or 500 years of history in a relatively short article. So I hope that answers your question.
Sure. Another broad question, who were the Crusaders? I mean, who actually went to these holy places and went with either the intent to defend or to wage war? Who were they?
Well, it depends a little bit on what time period and which crusade you're talking about. But really, it ultimately involved all of Europe because they perceived that Islam was on the march, which in fact it was, and that it was threatening to take over Christian territory. And so by the time of some of the later crusades, the popes urged everyone to be involved in some way or another, to fast, to pray, to give alms, and other ways to support the crusaders, even if they were not able to go themselves. But for the first crusade, and the ones, the first four at least, the ones that are probably best known, there is still a variety. When Pope Urban called for the first crusade, he had in mind nobles and professional soldiers going to help defend Constantinople and the Christians in the East and opening the way to Palestine. But the response was tremendous throughout Europe, and hundreds of thousands, really, certainly tens of thousands of ordinary citizens took up the call to go on a crusade, and some of them just began marching right away. This is the so-called People's Crusade that preceded the first formal crusade, and most of them came to a relatively sad end some of them did make it to Constantinople, but most were killed or died along the way. And so it did involve ordinary citizens, but the more successful and what Urban had in mind when he called for this attempt to liberate the Holy Land was governmental leaders, respected leaders, that is, recognized princes and nobles to lead the crusade, and their soldiers and retainers, generally men of military age. The Pope and others who preached the crusade tried to discourage younger men or old or younger boys or older men from going, and so it was intended to be a thing that applied only to a limited number of people.
Now, Pope Urban certainly could not have been ignorant of just war theology, just war theory, as it had come down and was continuing to evolve in the church at the time. Did he make any attempt when he began to proclaim or to promulgate the First Crusade to bring his call into line with the church's thinking on what a just war is, both in its cause, but also in its the way it's carried out?
Well, yes. I don't have any evidence that he specifically referred to Augustine, for example, or tried to craft the document that he preached in a particular way to make it line up with just war theory. But from what we do have of his speech at Clermont, again, historically this wasn't recorded at the time, and so we have only those who attended writing about it later, and that does give us a bit of difficulty. But he said, at least according to one of these later chroniclers, your brethren who live to the east are in urgent need of your help. The Turks and the Arabs have attacked them and conquered as far west as the shore of the Mediterranean and the Hellespont. So, again, he's in this later chronicle, or if it's accurate, Urban is saying, okay, there are Christians in the east. They need help. They've been attacked. And so that would be a defensive element to the Crusades that certainly does fit with just war theory. One of the prime criteria of a just war is that it's primarily a defensive war. So there are examples like that. And in other cases, he talks about, that is, Urban talked about those going on pilgrimages and dying along the way, and the need for people to go and defend them and to open up the routes to safe travel to Jerusalem and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So there are certainly elements within Urban's original call for this crusade. In fact, he didn't call it a crusade, and the crusaders didn't call themselves crusaders. They called themselves pilgrims, and they took a holy vow to travel to Jerusalem, but certainly they were armed, and certainly they were going to be defending themselves and trying to open routes for others to follow, so it definitely involved a war, but they didn't call it a crusade.
You also point out that Urban II may well have had a motive to kind of deal with the new converts into the Holy Roman Empire from a more warlike people, the Northern Europeans, and, as you say, export troublemakers by means of the Crusades. Tell us about that.
Well, this is something that people oftentimes don't remember or don't think about, but Vikings from the Scandinavian countries had been raiding into France and many other places in the 10th century, in the early Middle Ages, most of us would call it, I think. But in 911, the King of France made a deal with a Viking leader named Rollo that man and his supporters, his group, could settle in Normandy in France if they would become Christianized. And so Rollo more or less said, oh, we can have all this territory for nothing, and all we have to do is get some water poured on us, no problem. but in essence, these folks that settled down in Normandy were Vikings, and many of the Crusaders in the 11th century, the 1000s, were Normans, that is, people who had been Vikings who had settled in Normandy in France And so they were only a couple of generations removed from the essentially pagan marauders who we all know as pretty fierce warriors, these Vikings. And so there were constant fights in Europe between nobles of various sorts, one Christian fighting another Christian group. And several popes had tried to limit that in various ways. They had tried to say there were certain holy days that war should not take place on those days, and that for periods of time there should be peace, the peace of God. And so what I'm trying to argue is that I think Erpman wanted to redirect that aggressive tendency that was present in some of the Norman groups and others that were fairly recently Christianized. He says, for example, let those who have been accustomed unjustly to wage private warfare against the faithful now go against the infidels. And so, again, this is a later account, but he seems to be saying it's improper for you as Christians to fight one another, but it would be okay in the process of helping Christians in the East and opening routes to the Holy Land to fight a warfare against the infidels, or at least it would certainly be better.
Let's talk about that first crusade, the most well-known crusade, and perhaps, and certainly the one which is most closely associated with Urban's call. The later ones seem to have their own kind of momentum. But let's talk about it. If you could, you mentioned there the Peasants' Crusade, but once the thing is officially underway in about 1096, 1097, what is the goal of this first crusade?
Well, the goal is to capture Jerusalem at that point. Once they have passed through Asia Minor and territory that had previously been controlled by the Byzantine Christians, through a series of circumstances, these first crusaders, nobles from Europe, the son of the King of France, and the papal representative, a man named Adhemar, and so forth, had become less closely aligned with the Byzantine leader, a man named Alexius. And so by the time they have traveled through Turkey, they feel as if they're not so obligated to the wishes of the Byzantine ruler, to Alexius's wishes. And their goal at that point is to get to Jerusalem and to free it from control by the Muslim rulers. One thing that I didn't point out is that there had been problems and factions within Islam previous to the First Crusade. There were a group of Muslims ruling out of Egypt called the Fatimid rulers. They were Shiite Muslims, or they followed the Shia branch of Islam. And the Turks, who had been moving into Byzantine territory, were part of the Sunni or the majority group of Islam. And it's the attacks of the Turks that really caused Alexius, the Byzantine emperor, to feel as if he was on the defensive and to call for help in the first place. So I didn't mention that previously, but Alexius had actually requested aid from Christians in the West, so it wasn't just something that Urban thought up on his own. There had actually been a request there. But to get back to your point, by the time the Crusaders get to, let's say, Antioch in Syria, and through a rather interesting and, they would argue, miraculous series of circumstances, captured that very large and fortified city, their goal was Jerusalem, to free it from Muslim control.
I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the Crusades. Dr. Daniel Hoffman is our guest. He's Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland, author of the cover story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Hollywood versus History, Kingdom of Heaven and the Real Crusades. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. In about 15 minutes, we'll discuss A Dying Man's Consolation with Dr. John Seleska. Charles is calling from St. Louis. Thanks for your patience, Charles, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much. I guess my specific question is, what about the portrayal in the Kingdom of Heaven where the Crusaders are showing shown slaughtering Muslim populations, but the Muslims are shown, you know, being, you know, much more merciful. What about that portrayal?
Thank you very much, Charles.
I think the movie is very uneven in its treatment of the actual events. There were certainly some cases where Christian leaders, especially a man named Reynald of Chatillon, did attack Muslims and did violate truces and rather indiscriminately killed Muslims. But that was certainly not the norm. And on the other hand, there were Muslim leaders at various times throughout the whole Crusader period who were rather vicious and unprincipled in attacks on civilians and prisoners of war and so forth. So the Kingdom of Heaven movie is not a balanced portrayal, in my opinion. The only good Christians are ones who are really not committed to the Christian faith in any meaningful kind of a way. They're much more agnostic. The hero Balian of played by Orlando Bloom, Balian of Iblun, is thought by Orlando Bloom to be an agnostic, and so he plays it that way, and that's just not historically true for any of the Crusaders. Agnosticism was not something seriously regarded until a much more modern time period among folks who would claim to be Christians, at least.
You mentioned in your article that the excesses of leaders like Reynald actually may have served to consolidate warring factions among the Muslims at the time. So, and they certainly wouldn't have been unaware of that they could unite their enemy by being overzealous in the way they dealt with the Muslims.
Well, yes, that's true, but the movie is deceptive in that there is one place where, for example, the claimant to the throne, a man named Guy du Lusignan, says to Reynald, "Give me a war," and Reynald says, "That is what I do." Well, that's a line from the movie, and it certainly implies that Reynald was authorized by the regent at that point. He's not yet king of Jerusalem to go out and stir things up. Well, that's just not true. Guy, the king, had negotiated a truce with Salahuddin and the Muslims, and Reynald violated that truce. And he was not authorized to do that, and in fact was condemned for doing that, but it was too late. And these attacks by Reynald allowed Salahuddin to consolidate his power. There were always these factional struggles within the Islamic world as well, which is not portrayed very well in the movie either. But in that sense, Reynald was a negative impetus and allowed the enemies of the Crusaders, which controlled Jerusalem at that point. The movie setting is between the Second and the Third Crusade, so the successful First Crusade allowed the Crusaders to set up territory states within Palestine, and the Muslims were trying to recapture those between the Second and the Third Crusade. Anyway, Reynald was a goad, a stimulus to unite the Muslims.
Jobber is calling from St. Louis as our conversation winds down with Dr. Daniel Hoffman. Jobber, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Glad to be in on this. I am a Middle Eastern Christian, and I said the views of the Crusades are different from Westerners, and I think a lot of the historians in the West, especially lately, you know, in the past century, and you know, they just don't write the facts. They portray what they think the facts ought to be, and that is very, very sad, and that has reflected on the history of the Crusades. And now lately I have come across a book. Somebody gave me a book which I was supposed to translate. This was written by a Syrian cleric who was a scholar, and he had said he read all that there is on the Crusades and everything that was written from the libraries of France and England and the Vatican. And then he decided to write this book by going and exploring the monasteries or what is written about the Crusades.
And very quickly there, Jabber, what was the conclusion of the book?
Well, in the book, you know, I haven't translated it yet, but I've read it. It's very, very sad the way that the Christians were being treated by the Muslims before the Crusades.
Jabber, thank you very much. Your thoughts on this, Dr. Hoffman?
Well, yes, I would certainly agree with that. That's a part of the story that's often left out. There was actually a ruler from Egypt, a Fatimid ruler named Al-Hakam, that had rather systematically destroyed churches, as many as 30,000 churches destroyed and looted. He even had his troops hack away at the stone of Golgotha, where the crucifixion took place. And so these things are often not mentioned when people say Christians are terrorists. In fact, the Crusades were a response to things like this. Later on in time, there was a Islamic leader who's really still revered today in Islam named Baybars, who recaptures the city of Antioch that had been captured by the Crusaders in the First Crusade, as I mentioned. And he systematically goes in and kills men, women, and children. His actions even shock the Muslim chroniclers, which are caller might have been referring to. And so, again, and these are points I've tried to bring out. And some newer Crusade histories are bringing these things out, as well as trying to correct some common misconceptions from the past.
Dr. Daniel Hoffman is Associate Professor of History at Lee University in Cleveland. He's author of the cover story in the latest Christian Research Journal, titled Hollywood versus History, Kingdom of Heaven and the Real Crusades. Dr. Hoffman, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thank you.
Well, when we come back from this break, The Consolation of a Dying Man with Dr. John Seleska. Now, Dr. John Seleska is not a dying man. He might be nearer than I am to that moment, but he's not a dying man, and yet he is able to mine the depths of Scripture here in this next hour to give consolation to us all in the face of death. I'm going to be off here in just a moment to speak at a National Deaconess Conference up in Florissant, Missouri. And so we'll be playing this hour with Dr. John Seleska, as yet unheard hour of Issues, Etc., on the consolation for us all in the face of death, but in particular in the hour of death, coming up here in the next hour of Issues, Etc. Stay tuned. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.